True Crimers, welcome to Break the Case. I'm your host. I'm Jen Coffendaffer. Really excited today again about the show. We again are looking into the kidnapping of Nancy Guthrie, who was taken from her home in the witching morning hours of February 1st. She was taking her pacemaker disconnected from her phone at approximately 2:28 in the morning. Yesterday, we had on Steve Pagano, who was amazing. I hope you have a chance to watch that show. He was really one of my favorite guests I've ever had. He was so learned and knowledgeable about statement analysis. Again, he learned from Peter Hyatt, who, for those of you who are in the true crime community, where all of you are, he is just really considered the grandfather, the best of the best regarding statement analysis. And so it was really great to have one of his proteges, if you will, on. I personally consider myself sort of a protege of Greg McCrary, having the honor of working with him and working for the same company after our lives in the bureau. So in any event, he was just great. It was really, I think, important for those of us who believe these notes are attached to the kidnappers, whoever took Nancy. I truly do believe that. I believe that, though, from the beginning, after, of course, we saw the outreach of the family, the FBI's involvement, the orchestration of what was said by the family to the individuals, and then, of course, really reinforced once we started hearing what was in the notes, and then finally to be able to see the notes. I want to introduce our guest. She is not backstage yet, but I have no doubt she'll be here shortly. We have been communicating on and off for days now, and I'm really excited to have her. I'm going to introduce her and hoping that she'll jump in, hopefully right after this introduction. She will be backstage. So let me go ahead and introduce Lena Sisko. She's a former Department of Defense certified military interrogator and Naval Human Intelligence Officer. She served in the Global War on Terror as an interrogator at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. She authored You're Lying: Secrets from an Expert Military Investigator to Spot the Lies, Get to the Truth, and Marine Scout Snipers. True stories from U.S. Marine Corps snipers. In 2015, she gave a talk where she was this. Sorry, deceptive analysis expert on a TV show called TEDx for years. I have to tell you that the only reason, and you guys know I never read, right? I just have it memorized to go, but there was so much on her, I just didn't want to fail her in my introduction. So I'm reading it verbatim. In October of 2013, she founded the Congruency Group. Today, she trains law enforcement, government agencies, and companies all over the world in strategic interviewing methods, elicitation, body language, deceptive analysis, enhanced communication, and leadership skills. What's interesting is her BA is in anthropology, of all things, from the University of Rhode Island, and an MA in archaeology from Brown. So she's an Ivy Leaguer. She's a certified, let's see, she has a certificate in the psychology of leadership from Cornell, and she's certified in organizational change management. So that is just a little bit about our expert. We're going to be going over the notes again today with her. I still do not see her backstage. I reached out for her reached out and communicated with her this morning. And so everything was on track. I'm just hoping that perhaps she just has some sort of glitch. But in the meantime, I really want to say I appreciate each of you being here and to talk about Nancy. I think it's interesting, and I'm not sure we got to talk about it much, but of course, last week or so, the FBI had returned. And I wrote a lot about it on X, but I don't think I actually came on to talk about it much on the channel here. Essentially, what happened, as some of you might know, is there were these huge monsoons, these torrential rains that hit the area, Catalina Foothills and the Tucson area where Nancy's house is. And for any of you who have been a part of anything like that, the rains come in and all that dry desert, it just gets washed away, shoveled away. It literally can make the land look so much different. I actually have a case. Let me put it this way. Yeah, I have a case. But essentially, these monsoons have literally, to some degree, changed the terrain due to the washes that occur. They're called washes, where the water goes through like a river and just cuts deep into the desert that just gives way. So you can imagine, in my view, the intelligence of taking a relook of everything once everything shifted after the monsoons. That's what the only logical explanation I can come up with. Well, there's two. There's that, which is logical. And the other explanation could be, obviously, new information. Check out that roadway. You need to look back there. You missed something. Any sort of clue or hint like that would cause the Bureau to return and to go back. So that made a lot of sense to me. I also, so that's really the latest update on Nancy Guthrie, is that the Bureau, who I believe to be the Bureau, was back out there. We got some camera, some photography, some images, and it looks like Bureau to me. Also, in case we haven't touched on it much, I know we lightly touched on it, but we have a new detective from Pima County on it. For those of you who watch STS, and many of you know, Joel and I are definitely, we work a lot together, and really, I enjoy his show. And he had somebody on who specifically said there's a new detective in the house. The Bureau typically doesn't do things like that. In other words, just because we're 6 months past, they're not going to change who the case agents are. They're not going to change who the individuals are assisting. They might add to, they could take away somebody if they're called off on and needed for another assignment. But essentially, that just isn't going to happen in the Bureau. You're not, unless they've done something that shows impropriety or something like that. We just don't take case agents off in the middle of a case. This was never going to be a case that was solved rapidly. Yes, I did predict 6 months, and of course we did get a lot of information back in that 6 month period. You're seeing a lot of cages being rattled here at the 6 month period with the release of the notes, with a lot of information like that coming out. But essentially, I'm just here to tell you, I don't see the case agent being changed, but Pima County did change the detective. Remember, we know this detective, purportedly the initial detective, didn't have any time on the job as a detective, so he was pretty much a rookie given this huge case. And so it does make some sense to me that they would bring in somebody salty and seasoned, as it's being reported that has been done. I still don't see Lena in the house. I am not sure exactly what has happened, but I'm going to continue to update on news. She very much knows the time and the link. So we will just continue to wait, and hopefully she joins us very soon. I'm so looking forward to her expert analysis. Like I said, Steve's was tremendous yesterday, but as he even said, whenever they have a case and it involves any sort of note, you want to get all hands on deck that are experts in this area, that have time behind the tiller, I call it, for those sailors out there. The more time and seasoning you have in conducting investigations, the better you get, because you run into issues you have to resolve. And then next time when you see that issue, you've already have an idea how to approach it, how to tackle it. So that's why it's really important, in my view, to get different experts in. And I'm actually working on a third that will hopefully come on next week. And that'll kind of put together, you know, three of the major experts that we could find in this area of statement analysis for you all, because I think it's really important that you consider all these different views and advantages based on people's experience and their background, so that each of you can make a decision on you know, what you think about the notes and who might have written them. Just to kind of summarize where I'm leaning female, leaning English was their second language, leaning some AI help, leaning that this was empathetic, leaning that this was a surrogate writer, meaning not porch guy, but rather a surrogate that was actually part of now this conspiracy and had written this note. The tense is kind of screwed up because I think of the second language issues, but not porch guy, but a confederate of porch guy, and somebody that was definitely pushing for leniency, if you will, pushing for explanation as to why they committed this crime, you know, that they really only meant it to be a kidnapping, not to be a murder. And as Steve well pointed out yesterday, you know, all criminals and all of them, no matter what crime they commit, they will sit around the across the desk from you and legitimize their action, or do their very best to legitimize their action. It's really shocking. And, you know, as an interrogation technique, we obviously use that because we know everybody, it's a human nature to want to explain away bad actions, to want to provide an excuse that you can try to make look legitimate as to why you would do everything from committing a murder to hurting your own child to whatever it may be, to stealing, to defrauding people out of money. There is not one criminal I've sat across the desk from that thought they did something wrong, to be honest with you. That's just the way it is. Let me just double check that she's not in the studio yet. And I still don't see her. Let me double check my phone and make sure she has not reached out. She hasn't. And we communicated this morning. So I'm guessing something must have happened. I am not sure. So, but I do want to continue to update y'all on a couple of things in the true crime world since I have you here. Number one is Murdaugh, Alec Murdaugh. We're going to be covering that one close. And depending on how my expert cases are going at the time and where I'm at on my reports that I have due, I plan to, I really hope to cover that case. I'd like to cover it gavel to gavel. I just don't know if I'm going to be able to, but I really, really want to cover that case with at least some courtroom coverage, even if it's minimal, even if it's 2 to 3 days. I really want to get in the courtroom on that case. I think it's fascinating what's been happening. First of all, for those of you who don't know, the defense had a huge coup, and that coup was having the trial moved from the original county where the crime was committed to another county in South Carolina. This is really huge because obviously you can imagine the jurors that at least know about the case. And remember, just knowing about a case or hearing about a case does not disqualify you. What disqualifies you is if you've already have a preconceived notion or opinion on a case that will disqualify you. But nevertheless, they got it moved to a different venue. And, you know, I think it's fair. I think it's fine. Look, anybody in South Carolina, for the most part, they actually really have heard about Alec Murdaugh. They're going to already have some information because it made worldwide headlines, certainly national headlines, and of course in South Carolina. Nevertheless, so I just think it's always best to lean on the side of the defense with these rulings. If you're going to teeter, if you have any, you know, trepidation as a judge, you want to make sure you give them the fairest opportunity, because that's what our country is all about. So in any event, that's been changed. The other thing, though, the judge ruled on is, listen, the testimony before is going to be able to be allowed in of Alec Murdaugh. So they're not going to be able to pull any shenanigans in terms of not having him testify and the jurors not seeing how he was like a dog on a wet linoleum floor, spinning his paws all around when it was introduced, the snap video that showed, even though he had just lied and told this whole story that he was up at the house, that he was really down at the kennel. I'm glad that that is going to be allowed in. It'll be allowed in for any impeachment in case he takes the stand again. And so I think that was a critical ruling. I think it was the correct ruling. You can't just erase, since he already gave up his right to self-incrimination. You know, he didn't plead the fifth. He took the stand. So he's got to sit with that. And so I was happy to see that, because I can't think of a worse situation than for that not to be allowed and for him to take the stand now, Alec Murdaugh, and completely, you know, wordsmith and tailor what he was going to say to make it better better for his side and untruthful. In other words, to say, yeah, now I was down at the kennel and I was checking on a dog and then I left or whatever. So they caught him red-handed in a slew of lies all across the board. But I'm happy to report that Murdaugh, those statements will come in. I haven't been talking a lot about it, but I'm sure certainly keeping track of everything. As far as Brian Koberger, update on him. Brian Koberger, he is still fighting, motioning for a new trial based on incompetent legal representation by Ann Taylor, which couldn't be further from the truth. Look, I was not an Ann Taylor fan, because I saw that the public defender's office had represented several people involved in the case. In other words, parents involved in the victim parents representing them. And the rule in the FBI is, if you've represented anybody within a case, we just don't go back to that office. And they did. And then I was also pretty critical on the amount of money, I think $5.5 million paid to Ann and her legal team, which is, in my opinion, absolutely outrageous. The wage she received, the raise she received, I just thought it was horrible. And the way that she pushed everything to just drag on and on and on. And when you could have a simple hearing about, for instance, media, and she's got charts showing media reach. I mean, I got to say, I made two trial exhibits based on media reach in that case. But it was just ridiculous to have all these experts on and for the Idaho taxpayers to pay. All that to say is, she went out of her way to give an absolute rigorous and amazing representation for him. Like I said, a few things I thought were wrong, but all it did was bolster her representation of Brian Koberger. She didn't do anything that didn't intend and so on to help him. And he's basically coming out and saying Ann Taylor lied to him, that she made up these photos of what it would be like in his cell block, and that she withheld information from him concerning whatever was in Ethan Chapin's hands, and blah, 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 blah. I have no doubt that Ann is going to have copious records. None of this should be a surprise to anybody, of course, that Brian Koberger decided to pull this. We talked about it a long time ago. I know I did a long tweet about it right after he pled, saying he's going to pull this rule that allows, even when you give up your right to appeal, he's still going to be able to appeal, and he's going to dump Ann Taylor in the grease, which is what he's doing. Let me just double check again to see if there's anything from Lena as to what might have come up. Again, I reached out to her this morning at 10:30 and everything was a go. So I am not 100% sure where she is. So I wanted to update on that. Of course, the big news, and I wanted to do a show on this anyway, but was on Luigi Mangione. We followed Luigi Mangione. I'll never forget, I was in an expert witness conference when that came out on break, I found out, and I did show it on my lunch, I think, or maybe it was right after finding out about that shooting on a break, actually, I think. And nevertheless, I mean, it's unbelievable what Luigi Mangione did. He orchestrated going to New York City for the sole purpose of shooting Brian Thompson in the back. He used a 3D printer to create part of his gun. When you shoot somebody from that close of a distance, it's not very hard. He didn't even hit him very many times compared to the number of shots he shot. His gun was a piece of junk and ended up glitching on him all the time. It goes to show that even somebody who has no idea what they're doing, if you put a gun in their hand and you get that close to somebody, you're going to probably be successful at murdering them. And he was. A lot of people are asking, why would he plead? I mean, I have a couple of reasons I expected him to plea. He pled to the federal charges. Remember, federally, the jails are so much nicer. They have full on cable television, been in many of these institutions. They get to play baseball. They get to plant flowers. And I'm not just talking about the easiest club feds. I've been to some of the harder ones. And it's just the federal system has so much money, and it's going to be a much nicer place compared to a New York state prison, which would not be good. So he pled guilty. Do I think part of it was that? Yes. But I really do think that he was following in the steps. Again, he's the protege, if you will, in a sense, of Ted Kaczynski. He talks about Ted Kaczynski. He certainly, I think, fashioned himself as Ted Kaczynski, having this big reason to commit these crimes, and that they, you know, would somehow serve a purpose other than killing the father of two, and somehow, you know, in his delusional mind, think that that was somehow heroic. Nevertheless, if you all remember this, but Ted Kaczynski, who was a Unabomber, who also was responsible for murders, Ted Kaczynski pled guilty also to federal charges. And I well expected Luigi Mangione to do the same. Remember, in their minds, they're martyrs. They often, I believe, that people who can't be successful on their own, they, meaning working hard, doing what it takes to start at the bottom when you're in a job, work your way up, work hard. When that happens, a lot of people strive to be infamous. And you see this with a lot of these individuals who committed school shootings, individuals who commit mass murders. If they're not going to be famous, it's really easy to be infamous. And of course, the worst thing we can do is talk about them all the time. But we do. Greg McCrary points that out. Again, John Douglas's partner and writer of a lot of the Mindhunter script, and really his character as well in Mindhunter 2. He talks a lot about this, how we, the public, and sort of our thirst to understand and even advocate, you know, all of us who keep them out in the media, that's what they feed upon. And certainly Brian Koberger and Luigi Mangione fit that to a T. If you can't be famous, you can always be infamous. But I will say with Koberger, I think his is way deeper. That's a sick, sexual, sadistic murderous intent. Luigi just has a self-delusioned idea of who he is and what he could do, because he couldn't do anything. Just think if he would have taken his ideas of reforming healthcare and actually become a CEO of a United Healthcare something, and he had the backing, he had millionaire parents, he had a Ivy League education, he was charismatic, he had all the tools, but you know, and yes, I know he had a back problem, and you know what, he had surgery, and he was flitting all around the country as a trust fund baby will do, visiting all these wonderful places in Hawaii, so forth. Remember, he had a job for a very short period of time because he didn't like working. So I don't have any empathy at all, really, for somebody who goes in and cowardly shoots somebody in the back, taking them away from their children. Somebody like Brian Thompson, actually, he worked hard. He didn't have any money. His parents didn't have money. He's from Iowa. He went to a state school in Iowa, worked his way up, worked his way through school, worked his way up through United Healthcare. I have United Healthcare, and it's horrible, and it's shocking to me, you know, the amount of money that people just have healthcare is. Do I think it's deplorable? Absolutely. I don't understand it. I don't understand how we can't do a better job giving and getting affordable healthcare to people, because I know it can be done. I know it can be done, and I'm going to say why, and let me check and make sure Lena is not here. This is a first for me. I have never had this happen where a guest was unable to be on without, you know, letting me know. I'm assuming something happened, because we talked last night and again this morning at 10:37. So I'm not sure what happened. But let me actually check one other item, because I know many are, including me, are very much here. Let me just make sure there's no other communication. No other communication. But nevertheless, with Luigi Mangione, I just can't have empathy for somebody who would do that. He had a silver spoon. He had everything that he could possibly do, have, and he squandered it. I want to also quickly update on Lindsay Clancy. There were so many people that asked for me to cover that, and oh, thank you. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, Buffy. There is a lot that is going on out there that, because we follow the Nancy Guthrie case so closely, and we're going to continue to do that, that I feel like I am remiss in updating you all. And maybe I just need to do more shorter shows and do two or three a day with all these updates, because I'm excited about them. I'm on top of it, and I definitely want to deliver the information to you all. So thank you so much for that. And I love the dog pic. But nevertheless, on Lindsay Clancy, I've been covering that so tightly on a daily basis on my Twitter feed, X feed. And, you know, there was something that came out. Have you guys seen her Google searches? I mean, I've gone through all of her communications and what it was like, what she wrote, not only in her journal. I did one whole thing on that, the rundown on that, another with a rundown of her communications with her husband, you know, okie dokie. Yeah, give me the bowl. What would you like today? I mean, this is just really minutes before she murdered her children. She's going on, when I say minutes, might have been an hour, but I don't know, 50 minutes, 55 minutes. I don't know the exact minutes, but within an hour or so of committing these horrendous murders. We really honestly don't exactly know. I mean, she was communicating. She was texting. She was talking. She was calling the pharmacy. All this was going on. And a lot of people say, oh, Jennifer, you're not being fair to her, because do you realize that these episodes of psychosis can come on like that and then end like that? I'm like, well, really, no, I'm not aware of that, because I've been doing my own research, been listening to the experts, and the problem with these experts is they're both getting paid, which a good expert, it doesn't matter what you pay them, they are not going to represent a side they don't believe in. So I'm not one of these people that thinks, their opinion is paid for. In some instances, that can be the truth. But in most instances, most experts, they just turn down the job. If an individual comes to an expert, a lawyer, and you have your first conference call, which is usually an hour, listen, tell me the evidence. I might ask for something to be sent to me, especially if there's video, something like that. And then if you don't believe in it, the case, you just politely let them know, listen, I can't support your position. I'm sure there's other experts that can, and you pass it on along. There's no reason to take a case that you don't believe in, because believe me, there's so much expert witness work out there. No need for any expert who has already had their career, who has already fought hard for their reputation, to give it up by fighting for or supporting a vantage that they don't agree with. I don't even know how you could do that, because I don't know how you would be able to write a 50, 60, 70, 100-page report supporting your position when you don't believe in your position. Nevertheless, it's all to say that I don't believe the experts in the case of Lindsey Clancy, I don't believe that they're lying or anything along these lines. I just believe that they see it for the way they see it, because there's different ways you can view this postpartum psychosis. But everything I've read, all the different inputs that I've seen from different doctors, it doesn't just come on like that and end like that. And her drug usage also was something that's, yes, it looks terrible. She has 13 prescriptions, but I mean, the detective sat there and counted out the pills, and there'd be like 3 missing from this bottle, 2 from this bottle, a few more from this bottle over this long extended period of time. And she herself discussed how she was so worried about getting addicted. At one point she said she was addicted. Her healthcare professional said, well, didn't seem like you're addicted. It wasn't their opinion that they were addicted. I don't know. You know, the only person who really knows whether she planned this out and viciously murdered those kids is Lindsey Clancy. But there's a couple of indicators. For instance, did you guys see that she Googled, can a sociopath be fixed or healed? Let me get the exact verbiage, because I put this actually in a tweet. Her exact verbiage is, sorry, I just quoted it. Can you treat a sociopath? Okay. Can you treat a sociopath? Why? I mean, it's like she self-diagnosed herself as a sociopath, and she wants to know if she can be treated. And I just want to give you the definition, or at least typically what would define a sociopath: somebody with no empathy. They don't care how others feel. Of course, that's no empathy. Frequent lying or using charm to trick people, acting on sudden impulses without planning, breaking rules or laws, showing anger and aggression. And, you know, I just see a woman who was struggling that, you know, struggling with that. And, you know, her wondering, am I a sociopath? Also, I saw where she talked about she was traumatized, I guess, ferberizing her baby. Callan, now listen, I don't pass you. You know, parents do the very best they can do. That's all you can do, is the best you can do with the resources, the time, the number of children you have, the responsiveness of your parent, of your extended family and your husband and all of that, to sort of be there and be the best parental units you can be for your children. And some people believe in Ferberizing. If you don't know what that is, Ferber wrote this book, this Dr. Ferber. I read it when I had my first baby. I was 35. And I said, you know what, this is what we got to do. And so on one particular day, I can't remember, it was when my poor son was very, very young, after I nursed him and I put him to sleep that night, and then he cried. I can't remember how old he was, you know, probably, you know, many months old. And I'll never forget it. I sat there in the living room, just hearing that poor baby cry. And husbands, typically, I do think most husbands, maybe I'm wrong, but my husband very much deferred to me. I think understanding maybe a mother's love or something. Like I said, the only time I've ever been published, everyone, was I wrote a poem about my first son and about how it was the first time I ever really understood love, because you're just, they consume you. And I couldn't take it. I took it for about 2 hours, which was 2 hours, way too long. And I went upstairs and I took that baby out of that crib, and I never, any of my kids ever again. I'm not saying I'm right. I'm not saying anybody else is wrong. I'm just telling you, there's no like 18-year-olds you have to worry about sleeping in your bed or a bassinet right next to your bed. You don't really have to worry about that. So from then on, with all my babies, and I had a one-year-old and a one-month-old at the same time, my babies were right there with me, really up until, gosh, old, pretty old. I'm not going to lie, probably 5, 6, 7. We had them in little pallets on the ground because for whatever reason, they would just get scared. I don't know. I was always terrified when I was that age. I remember being in first and second grade thinking that Captain Hook was under my bed and just being terrified. And, you know, anyway, that's Jen Coffendaffer's parenting experience. And when I read that she was traumatized over having to, you know, teach him to sleep through the night, like I said, I don't pass judgment on any of it. I've been through it. I have three kids. It's, you know, it's tough to be a really good parent, and you have to really work and you have to sacrifice out of everything you have to do. If you just know you're going to have to sacrifice, that's it. Self, I'm going to have to sacrifice for about 25 years because that's how long it takes, whether you're talking emotional, physical, monetary sacrifice. It's a sacrifice to have a kid, but as long as you know that going in, you know, most parents do just fine. And I found it very interesting. Not that people can't empathize with some of the thoughts of Lindsay, but it's actually shocking to me, to be honest with you, that so many people want to make an excuse for her actions. You know, I've talked a lot about this, like the amount of time it takes. Yeah, 10 to 20 seconds until they're unconscious. Maybe. I mean, I think Cora put up a pretty good fight, judging from all the bruises she had on her body, and Dawson too. Today I was at church, and I have to tell you, have you ever been in church? Let me just double check that she's not here. I don't see her, everyone. I'm so sorry. Have you ever been in church and had... like you're sitting there and there's distractions in front of you? For instance, today, it sounded to me like our priest was like the teacher in the Peanuts. You know, the Peanuts cartoon? Wah, 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 wah. I wasn't in tuned because, and I know it's because this Lindsay Clancy case is going on, but in front of me, there were just all these children. So I'm going to explain just for a quick second what I saw. First of all, I saw a baby probably more like 4 months old, 5 months old, not 8, like Lindsay's, but, and that baby had just got done nursing. And for those of you who nursed, I nursed all my kids. When they get done nursing, like they just go like this, they just go, oh, it's so cute. They just throw their little chubby arms back and they just are in ecstasy. They're in heaven. Their tummies are full and they just fall asleep, just completely in your arms. Well, that's what this baby did. And this young woman, maybe 30, if that, 20s, early 30s, had this baby after, and just in her arms like that. And you could just feel this bond between this mother and this baby, and the just the total trust of that baby. You know, I know they're still developing, but just how they feel in heaven, basically. An ecstasy baby was that one. Then I noticed a kid, probably 5, 6 at the most, kindergarten type age, you know, still hadn't been confirmed, still going up to the altar like this. And that child was snuggled. So the dad was like this and he snuggled in here, yawning, you know, bored, but just so content in the arms of his dad as the service was going on. And then finally, and this was the one that really bothered me, 3-year-old, I'm going to guess, toddler, definitely not 2, definitely not 4. I really think 3, which I always said the terrible 3s for those of you who have had children. And oh my gosh, you guys, this just, you can tell, like they're constantly like up and down the pew, kind of just going to be more difficult to control, right? A lot of energy. And then I don't know why I looked away, but then I looked back because he was crying all of a sudden. I mean, he's like, oh, you know, crying. And then he runs over to the mom, right? He's a little further down the pew. He runs over to the mom and he's got that cry. Do you know that cry where they're not really hurt, but that cry where they're like feelings are hurt or they just need a hug, whatever happened, which I don't know. It was like an embarrassment cry for a 3-year-old, like maybe slipped off the pew a little bit and was embarrassed. I don't know. But he hugs his mom literally like it was going to be the last hug of his life. Like he, like, you know, she was the only person in the world that could take away his pain and his sadness. And that mom hugged back that boy. She didn't get mad. She didn't, you know, she just hugged that little boy back. And finally, she just kind of squeezed the sadness out of him. That's what I saw. Squeeze the sadness. And this was the cutest little blonde, just cherubby looking kid. Then, and I know I was totally distracted. Then he goes and sits on the mom's lap and he just starts like grabbing her cheeks and like tracing her eyebrows and playing with her hair. And she's just sitting there like a, you know, a stuffed animal, just getting mauled kind of. And he's just studying her face and you can just see she is his whole world. That's what, when I was watching that, I'm like, she is his whole world. If he's sad, if he's happy, and he just wanted to feel every part of her face and a look in her eyes. And of course, she just sitting there like, okay, whatever. And I remember that from when I was young, the kids just wanting to like maul my face, like we were silly putty or something. It's so funny. And I was in that moment, and I wrote actually a long tweet and then I didn't send it. But that moment, I thought, there is no drug, no Valium, because that was the main thing she was taking, that and Adderall, I guess, that can make a person destroy that 3-year-old, that you are their everything, that could destroy that 5-year-old, that they're so smart and that they need their parent so much to console and to just nestle with and to feel whole, much less that little baby. I'm not buying it. She Googled the sociopath. She's talking about ordering bowls and what do you want for dinner? And don't forget the Pedialax. No. Nah. She was tired and she was done. And she talks about it in her own words in the writings. Anyway, I had to just touch on that because I tell you, church was tough today for me to watch that. I'm going to check one more time. I've kept you all here for almost an hour. Like I said, I touched base with her this morning as well as last night. And anyway, I'm sorry that we didn't have the show that I had planned. But what we have coming up Wednesday morning at 10 a.m., we're doing a show on Lindsay Clancy. I have a doctor, a PhD. I've had her on before. Her name is Dr. Eppright, Camilla Eppright. She's brilliant. Again, another Ivy Leaguer, tenured for years at the University of South Carolina, as well as Furman University. I don't think she holds the same opinion I hold. And as you all know, I am very, very much want to get people on here that aren't sounding boards, but rather can give you all both sides to consider as you're looking at the case like Lindsay Clancy. Yeah, I did reach out, by the way, Kelly, and there's just nothing. It's very strange. I was thinking maybe she thought Central instead of Eastern. I double checked. Everything says Eastern. I reached out to her and I just said, just checking in, is all okay? Please let me know if there's any issues. So I haven't heard anything back. Like I said, at 11 o'clock this morning, everything was good. Nevertheless, 10 o'clock on Wednesday, I will have on Dr. Eppright. I'm really going to let her talk and explain her side of her research and her thoughts on this. She is very empathetic. She has had her own serious medical issues. I think hers is I don't want to say what hers is, but it's nothing to do with mental, but it's very serious physical situation. And so I'm so glad she's going to be able to join us. That's Wednesday at 10. I'll put something out for sure. I'm going to get with Lena and I'm hoping that maybe she'll join us Monday or Tuesday. And I'm also working on another statement analysis expert. I'm fascinated with the notes. I am fascinated with how they were written. Again, I believe them to be very true. And I just want other experts that this is what they do for a living. They teach it. They know it to come on and add to the conversation because they really do add. Steve was amazing. If you want to watch a show and didn't get a chance to catch Steve's yesterday, I'm going to actually highlight it because it's really one of the best discussions I think we've ever had on the notes and that I've ever heard discussed about the notes. Was his input. And so it was really worthwhile to watch. If you watch and you're really involved in the Nancy Guthrie case, I think it's a really good session to watch. I will keep you updated on Lena and probably via a tweet. Again, I am not sure what happened, but my deepest apologies that Lena couldn't be here. And secondarily, I hope I got you all caught up on true crime and the crime you care about, the crime stories you care about. Everybody, until next time, I appreciate each and every one of you. Thank you, mods, for being here. And thank you to each of you. May justice be served for the Guthrie family and for all those who are missing.